Welcome to another edition of Stuck at Ohm with Ohm Malik. My guest today is Riley Brennan, co-founder of Trucks.VC, a venture firm focused on investing in mobility and related technologies. Welcome, Riley.
Ohm, thank you so much for having me here. It's great. Yeah. I'm drinking your coffee, overlooking the bay.
It's a really good coffee.
It's a great coffee.
I mean, it's like I don't taste coffee like chocolate for just about anyone.
Yeah, I know.
Except for you.
Yeah, thank
you. Because like me, you're a blogger and blogger turned VC and, you know, you worked hard. So what makes you a good VC? Did blogging prepare you for being a good investor?
I mean, I think what makes me a good investor is if I show returns, right? That's the ultimate answer. But
I would say giving out checks.
Yeah. Well, ultimately giving out bigger checks than I received. Why I love the job is a lot related to why I liked journalism when I was young, which is that I got to talk to a lot of different types of people and synthesize that and ultimately make decisions. I started out loving the car business when I was a kid. So I had posters of Porsches and Volkswagen on my wall when I was growing up in the 80s outside of Detroit. And when I went to undergrad, I worked at a car magazine, which was owned by Prime Media. And that was a really interesting job. It was my first job in the auto industry in 1997. So I've been in the car business for over 25 years.
So, you know, I've never had a poster of a car on my, you know, room wall because I didn't have a room. Though I did work for a magazine which printed posters. And my favorite poster was of that of Samantha Fox. So you know where my interest lay,
right?
So not in cars,
right,
but in what cars are used to attract, right, for boys.
Yeah, absolutely.
I went straight to the end result.
Right.
See, that's why I'm a better blogger. I synthesized better.
Right, totally.
But your car interests, your interest in auto industry, as a journalist, as a blogger, as a design person, as an investor, is it because you're from Michigan?
Probably a little bit. You know, in the Detroit area, I think if your parents don't work in the auto industry, you know, they're probably influenced by somebody who does. So maybe they own a flower shop or a dentist office and their clients work in the auto industry. So there's something for certain about growing up there, which is in the water and in the air. I just happen to love the car business such that I wanted to work at a car company when I was really young, either in vehicle development or maybe, you know, if I, depending on the type of day I was having, maybe the CEO. So I always wanted to be in the car business somehow. And when I was a freshman at Michigan, I worked at Automobile and it was a $7 an hour job. And I was washing and gassing the cars that the editors were going to review for the magazine. And the reason I got to writing is because it was just the beginning of the web. And they got their first website. And it was, if you remember that era in magazine publishing, you had a magazine that would have a print product, which is really the bulk of all the journalists and where all the revenue came from. And then it, they'd say like, oh, we've got this website on the side.
Sounds
and we don't care about that. And so I was raising my hand saying, I'll do whatever I can just to, you know, have little dribs and drabs of whatever project you want to give me. I really started writing because there was an opening and I just hung around that office as much as I could. And, you know, the rest, I worked in the car business for the rest of my life, always kind of trying to attack it from a different angle. And I spent my first 10 years or so as a journalist and the last 10 years being an investor.
You know, the funny thing about your story is that you came in at the rise of, at the start of the web revolution, and at a time when the U.S. car industry was somewhat on a slump.
Right.
Right. Yep. So you grew up in Detroit, you experienced like how a one industry town or one industry state kind of, you know, grapples with changing fortunes.
Yeah. And those posters on the wall were not of domestic cars. I mean, they were Volkswagens and Porsches and things like that. So I loved the car business, but I didn't look, I didn't pine to drive a Camaro in 1988. You know, I wanted a, not that I could drive 1988, but I wanted a Volkswagen GTI or wanted a Porsche 959 or something like that. So I had a, I had this interest in getting in the industry, but the domestic car business was decaying in that period of time for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting. Like, I never really have been able to figure this out. I'm kind of switching gears a little bit here. Is that we have an American car company which is selling cars to Germans, to Japanese, to the Koreans, to the Chinese. And yet, you know, our politicians seem to cater to the companies which are making cars of yesterday.
Right, right.
And I just don't understand it. You know who I'm talking
to. Of course, yeah.
Do you have, like, I look at that and I just like, wow, that's like American product which people want to buy. Sort of like, you know, and it's made here, not made elsewhere, like, you know, like, which is very different than, you know, like even iPhone, which is made in China.
Sure.
Some other country. And
yeah,
you know, it's just like
there's something about the way that you're describing that so well, because I think, you know, even the term Big Three, which itself is, you know, a misnomer, because the third company in that, Chrysler, Stellantis, whatever you want to call it, isn't fundamentally an American company anymore. I mean, they're American divisions of it. And you would think that by now we would have changed that to say Big Four to include Tesla. But when really, when people talk about, quote unquote, the American auto industry, they're usually talking about the old and three big industrial American companies. And they almost think of Tesla as this kind of unholy other entity, which is really fascinating. And to your point, doesn't reflect the incredible amount of change in the last 10 years that Tesla has kind of wrenched upon the world and the domestics.
I mean, what we are seeing with Tesla, and I don't want to be a Tesla fanboy, but what they have done is basically popularize the idea that car is a computer, right? Just like the iPhone popularized the idea the phone is a computer and took market share away from the Nokia, Ericsson, Sony Ericsson, and like all those companies. Remember, you and I have written about them and used them, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we are not internalizing in our language and how we refer to cars. The reality is that cars are more software and chips than actually the engine itself.
And maybe I would add to that by saying probably the first company to say a lot of the qualities that the big three demand go into a product, whether it's panel fit or reliability or certain parts that you can't find in it, certain aspects of the Tesla experience that are lacking, actually don't matter to most Tesla buyers, because the thing that they do get right is the incredible focus on software. And the, I think in some ways, the total appreciation of the phone as a center aspect of your personality and your identity. And I think today, especially if you look at the survey data around people using CarPlay and Android Auto, people think about their car after they've made their phone choice. And Tesla doesn't get a lot of things about the car business right, but it doesn't matter, because they get these, they've really defined these new things as being essential. So it's almost like they've done it better by being so different to the right moment when people cared a lot more about their phone than they did their car.
I think when I think about Tesla, look, you know very well, I don't know how to drive. And so I'm like the wrong guy to be talking about cars. But when I see, or when I'm sitting with my friends who own Tesla, and there's quite a few of them, you can actually see that the car experience is a behavior. It's not like, I think, just like old phone companies, Nokia and Ericsson and Sony Ericsson, they were making phones like a product, and iPhone came and changed behavior,
right? Yeah.
And like, I look at, when I sit in Tesla, you actually start to see behavior changes, right? Like, the phone just you put there is charging, it's connected to your music. Like things are just like weirdly just like a smartphone. It's like smartphone with four wheels and like a lot of compute and batteries, right? Like, and I just kind of feel like that is the part the auto industry still doesn't get. Like, it's not just the big three. All of them don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're still making a product. And it's not just a product. It's like a behavior shift which has happened. And you see the differences in people who are younger who own Tesla versus people who are older who own Tesla.
Yeah, I think I would agree with most of that. The one thing about Tesla that maybe will be at odds in the next few years is I think it's a great company, even if the automated driving dreams aren't realized. So even if it's just a great electric car with a really great way to interact with your personal devices and a really great screen, that's frankly so much better than most car companies and maybe even all of them, that it should probably be, and if they ship enough units, should be worth more than all the other companies. And the big question mark, I think, is if the things they want to do on the service aspect of automated driving don't work out, does that mean that Tesla itself was a failure? Or is it just that particular vision of what it could be and what it should be valued at? Will it disappoint the Adam Jonases of the world and the analysts who cover Tesla? So as a car industry person, I think they've already really achieved so much. And it's kind of good enough for me what they've done. And I hope that they don't try to do too much and fly too close to the sun. And you could point to a lot of things that have happened with FSD and other things where I don't think those are necessarily in the right path.
Well, I think that's a different story. When companies start to justify their valuation,
mm-hmm.
that's when things start to go wrong. And I think I worry about that with Apple. I worry about, you're already seeing it with Google, like the way the search experience has deteriorated so much. And so I think that's always a risk for all companies. I think what I was actually trying to get to is that the language of what, like around phones back in, like in through the 2000s and the phone industry, the vernacular around what was phone and what was phone-based activities yeah. was very different than what it was before the iPhone. And I think it changed the behavior, how we experience information and all those interactions with each other. And like a lot of the social change which happened was a behavior change because of a device which didn't look like a phone.
Right.
Right. And so when I see those kind of things and I just see our society at present, we are using vernacular of the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we just had like Tesla asked to recall 2 million cars. And I was like, is that a recall when they can do
OTA?
OTA. Yeah. Is it like, you know, what's the better language there? Is it like, and when you look at crews getting into trouble or like all these cities and governments getting hoity-toity around self-driving cars, I'm just like, but you don't have any rule. You don't have a legal definition of what a car company can do and it cannot do. What crews can't, I mean, you know, crews is a different story.
Mm-hmm.
They have, it's very common. But my point is that we have still this archaic industrial era idea of what mobility is. And like we clearly, 2023, which is one of the main reasons I wanted to sit down with you was, look out. Like this has been a year of big change. No one seems to have noticed in all the hoopla around OpenAI and ChatGPT, but this is a big year for mobility.
It is, yeah.
I don't know what you think.
Yeah, in the language front, you know, with the recall, and today there was an announcement for thousands of Teslas, you know, that are, and the term recall is actually an official government term, which says you have to do this particular thing. The way that is administered is really up to the manufacturer. So Tesla's choosing to perform this recall via OTA. They do a bunch of other OTAs, which are not compulsory, but this one, because of the recall language, actually is. And most manufacturers, when we've historically heard the term recall, we think, okay, we got to take it back to the dealer. And in this particular instance, you won't have to do that with Tesla. You just will receive an update. But I do think the language in some ways is really the thing that's failed a lot of the automated driving space and will require better language. I don't know if the language will have to change on the regulator side as much, but I do feel like the language, particularly with these forms of driving which aren't yet full automation and are kind of driver assistance, is where humans get into a lot of trouble because we really frankly believe that the system does more than it's capable of. Mm-hmm. And Tesla, the words that Tesla use, I think are frankly are not helpful because yeah. they make people believe that they're actually automated vehicles.
Dude, hype helps us talk. I mean,
right.
Yeah. But let's talk about 2023. I think yep. this has been such an amazing year.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about 2023? How would you sum it up? What are the things which you
yeah.
think were pivotal and important?
A few things. One is on the AV side, in certain areas, you can just use automated vehicles like you would an Uber. And, you know, I know you've been doing Waymo recently. I use Waymo now in San Francisco like I used to use Uber. It's the experience of an Uber Black, but the price of an Uber X. And I've taken a lot of Waymo rides. I was taking cruise rides until they stopped the service, but I do prefer the Waymo experience just in an apples to apples comparison here in SF. So you have automated driving that has received some level of government approval in certain areas that's actually working. Then if you look at the ADAS side, so driver assistance systems, you have an incredible rise in valuation in companies like Mobileye, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, which are really the new, in some ways, the new tier ones that are making those driver assistance or ADAS systems. They're now worth, I mean, if you, obviously, because NVIDIA is worth over $1 trillion, but the surprise there is that the ADAS companies are worth more than the AV companies. So in some ways, it's like the junior varsity football team beat the varsity team because we didn't expect that was going to happen. And those systems are now so ubiquitous that even on the lowliest Mazda or whatever you can buy, you have a really interesting ADAS system.
So it's very much like the phone story playing out again. You had like standardized, you know, chipsets,
yep.
you know, modems, everything, you know. So like, what were the key things? Like I saw mm-hmm. a bunch of reports, like I've been reading a bunch. Highest ever sales of batteries this year, yeah. highest ever sales of EVs this year, especially right. in China.
Yeah.
And like, we always look at the world only American centric
yeah.
approach. Clearly, like, there is stuff happening.
Yeah. And we're almost at around 10% of new car sales as EVs in the US. You have a lot of government incentives because of Build Back Better and IRA in 2022. Whether or not those are going to remain is a big question, I think, for the industry and for investors, because who knows who's going to be president in 11 months. So you have EVs definitely either from the public market side and from the consumer side growing. However, in the last few months, there's probably some more rational questions asked about, do pure battery electrics need to be applied to every vehicle format and every size? And the answer to that is probably no. There's definitely been a rekindling of interest in hybrids, because for some large vehicles, it might make more sense for the next 5 years that you have a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid. And Toyota, oddly, and perhaps perpetually, has made these kind of statements that it doesn't make sense to have all the lithium you'd use for one Tesla. You could take that and put it into a multiple of, I think, 10, you know, Priuses or something like that. So the BEV hybrid and potentially hydrogen world is really starting to emerge. So like any time in the car business, you have all these different kind of inputs and outputs, and it's a really sort of difficult time to make sense of. But this was one of the most impactful years because of you have powertrain changes, automated driving changes. You have a lot of companies going through consolidation, going out of business. You have a lot of, you know, potentially some big changes with Cruise and how that impacts GM. So it's probably the quote unquote craziest year it's ever been.
What stands out for you in terms of the startup war?
Definitely battery technology and things related to charging. That's become the bulk of the trucks pipeline. So trucks invest in transportation at large. We'll do passenger car stuff, commercial vehicles, aviation, aerospace, insurance stuff, I mean, fleet stuff. So it's everything that moves people or goods. And in the last year or two, over half that has become stuff related to decarbonization. And I think there are a lot more software battery business models than people appreciate. I'll give you one example. Most vehicles right now are shipped with way too big of a battery. It's not because Americans are, you know, simply want longer range, although many of them do. It's because the manufacturers note that there's such a variance in the cells they get from manufacturers that they typically have to put more battery in than it's actually necessary. And they don't have a good way of modeling those batteries over many different cycles. So over 10 years, they're not super accurate about how they model them. So they put in a much bigger and therefore more expensive battery pack. We are potentially moving to a world where we're actively controlling those batteries in the field. When you do that, you can probably ship a battery that's about 20% smaller, 20% cheaper across the whole fleet if you were to manage that software live. And that type of software business doing that is definitely a $1 billion business, if not more. Because if you just look at the value you're saving in the actual capex of the vehicle, it's enormous. So there's a company here in SF called Zitara that we're an investor in. That's what they're doing. I didn't think of that when we first started doing trucks, that there would be meaningful software businesses in battery and charging, but there really are.
So when this reminds me a little bit again of the smartphone industry, where both Google Pixel and even iPhone, like, they use software to increase the battery life
right.
of the phones.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's the optimization of software. And I wonder, do you have any insight into how semiconductor companies are working on it? Kind of, you know, just like the mobile industry benefited
yeah.
from low power chips. Like
your M1. Yeah, of course. I mean, this is what the argument could be made that in the future, a car company has to build their own chips, and they have to build, if they're going to build their own batteries and they want to build world-class batteries, they also need to build their own chips or at least design them. And in the past, like even if you look 3 years ago, no manufacturer was looking at mining and buying metals all the way that far up the supply chain and didn't have any interest really pre-COVID.
Except Tesla.
In looking into their chip suppliers. It was really not a concern of them. And automakers over the years, really for the last 30 years, aren't really makers of many things. They're really aggregators of their tier one and tier two suppliers. So if you and I were running, let's say, BMW, and we wanted to build a new SUV, the common thing you would do is go to your Bosch and Continental and Valeo, and you really ask them to bid on projects and modules that you, at the end of the day, pull together to make a car. And the big question for the future is that actually might be an archaic framework for how cars and their suppliers get organized. You actually might have to go to this world where you have to do chips and batteries, because if you want to take advantage of the software that can control the batteries, you have to do that.
Yeah. I mean, this is why you kind of wonder if the Chinese are going to win this one.
Perhaps, right?
Yeah.
Although, I mean, you could argue in chips that the Chinese aren't yet as world-class as some other regions, but they will potentially get there. The biggest, you know, consumer of certain types of chips is the auto industry. I think the U.S., the overall, if you think of the next sort of 20 years, as much as we've heard about supporting battery and the ecosystem around batteries for the U.S., the same has to be said for chips. And there's certainly a handful of big projects underway. But overall, you could argue there's a national security aspect of chips and batteries, not just for the good of GM and Ford and Tesla, but really for the future of a lot of different technology businesses, which will probably use battery and chips that we don't even know about yet.
Yeah. So let me ask you a little bit like a different question, a curveball. Why do we have to have cars? I mean, if we are at the cusp of redefining mobility, why does an individual have to drive somewhere with three seats being empty? Mm-hmm. Why is that an idea of a vehicle so dominant? And I ask you this because you're a Detroit boy.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And you've grown up loving cars. Sure. And I have a very utilitarian relationship with cars. They take me somewhere and I couldn't care less about that.
Right. I mean, part of it is in the U.S., right? Like we've underinvested in the things that allow you to avoid a car. And almost structurally, we collectively have forced you to own or use a car so much that when you use enough expensive sharing services, you realize, I might as well just buy a car. It's the same thing, I think, that you're seeing in micromobility, where if you use a bunch of shared Lime scooters over a period of a month, you pretty quickly do the math. You're like, I could just buy one of these scooters. And the same is definitely true in shared use of vehicles. So a better answer could be like, oh, well, you live in a place that where you don't have to do that. And that is true in certain markets within the US, but not everywhere. So if you're in Europe, there's an easier answer to that. So it's kind of almost in some ways a structural problem more than it is a car maker issue, that you, if you were lucky enough or unlucky enough to be born in the suburbs of Huntsville, Alabama, you're probably stuck in an area where you need to at least access or own a car.
Yeah. You don't think we actually ever break the shackles of the truck and the car anytime soon?
If you look at the trends around the fact that kids don't really want to learn how to drive a car and don't want to own a car, I think what we'll see is that you have much later use of a car. But then there are these kind of critical life moments that I think, frankly, a car makes a lot of sense to own when you have to do things with kids that maybe gets a little bit bigger than a cargo bike, or you live in an area where the weather is such that a car makes more sense. So in certain areas, I think it just makes a lot of sense to have a car, but it's because of the structural aspects of where you live, not because of the fact that I love a car versus not loving a car. Mm-hmm. So when we lived here in San Francisco, you know, we had one car and we didn't really use it that much.
Now you have two?
And now we have two cars.
You have a Bronco?
And we have a Bronco, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a good looking car.
It's great, yeah.
I mean, I'm not a car guy,
yeah.
But that's a good looking car.
Yeah, it's an own car. Yeah. I can see you driving a Bronco. Definitely. I can see you riding in a Bronco.
Especially if they're doing an EV version of that.
I think eventually there'll be an EV Bronco. Yeah. It'll be great. Yeah,
totally. I'll probably raise it a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like tiny me should look big.
Yeah, just something that looks special.
I do like the F-150.
You do?
I also like the F-4s, the 350 or the 550, the big one.
Like the Super Duties and stuff like that? Is that because, you know, you have a sister that lives in Michigan?
No, I just think that's like so American.
Yeah, it is very American.
It's like I can wear my, you know, my citizenship on my sleeve.
Yeah, your Carhartt jacket and your Alden boots and your F-150.
No, dude, I'm going to wear Danner boots.
Okay, all right.
I mean, once I, like, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe Red Wings.
Yeah.
No, I really like the big truck. I failed my driving test 3 times. Come on, dude.
Yeah.
I'm not driving anytime soon.
We'll get you there eventually. So you've tried Waymo now for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, dude.
Let's talk about that.
The best driver on the road right now is a computer.
Yeah.
And I just can't believe it's happened. I wrote an article, I think in 2012, waiting for driving Go-Kart or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was about waiting for self-driving. I think it was, maybe I spent some time with
Google team.
No, with Elon.
Okay. Yeah.
I bought into it and I just waited and waited. And it's like, I don't need to learn. I live in a big city. And then I said, like, it would be so cool. And like this year, you know, you sit in a Waymo, you know, the self-driving thing, it's goddamn there. It's not fiction.
Yeah.
You can just see this could be the way things will be in the future.
That's great.
I just not like it. I love this experience.
Me too. It's great. The other thing I didn't realize until I started using them is when you have a normal, you know, human piloted Uber and the car arrives, I always feel rushed to kind of go downstairs and get in the car because I think oh, my driver rating or just the personal connection of the driver. I don't want to make the driver wait because I know the driver's trying to make as much money as possible during that hour. So I'm always rushing to get to my Uber and I'm even at the curb before the car arrives. But with the Waymo, you get the alert and it says you have 5 minutes. And actually, it's interesting because I don't feel stressed to go down and immediately go down and get in the car. You know, I can, you know, finish up, put my jacket on, whatever I need to do, and then go downstairs. I know I have this 5 minute block of time. And it actually just makes the total experience a lot less stressful, in addition to the fact that the service is good and the car is clean.
Car's super clean.
Yeah.
I think every time I've had an outlier experience in Waymo, it has been outside the car, human.
Right.
In,
like a,
interference.
Somebody blocking a one-way street.
Or intentionally coming in front of it. Like people working on the road.
Sure.
Putting a hand on the sensor.
Right.
Like little stupid human tricks is how I would call it.
Yeah.
Like,
Dave Letterman.
Dave Letterman's is a stupid dog trick.
Yeah. That's going to happen for a while, but
it annoys the hell out of me. It's like, people are so stupid. Like, you can actually see it, like, because now you're sitting there in a car with no human, and you see all idiotic behavior around you, how people drive, and how terrible they are, and it's like, hey, maybe it's okay to have a computer guiding you where you need to go.
Yeah, I think the really interesting part about this year is, so in the summer, the California CPUC, California Public Utilities Commission, approved for the ability for these services to charge money in California so they could actually do ride hailing like we're doing now and run your credit card and everything. It was kind of a big win for them. And obviously in the last couple months, because of an incident that happened with Cruise in early October, Cruise has now paused their entire fleet. There's all this management changes. So at the outside, whenever I talk to a journalist, they're like, wow, AVs are over, aren't they? And I'm like, well, I guess, and if you look at that, if you look at a couple of different stories, I would agree with you. But on the other hand, I've never had experiences like I've had in my life driving with Waymo here in SF. I've never had that before. And
my sphincter is clenched most of the time in an Uber. And now I think that
this is a good ohm metric.
Yeah. It's oh my God, this guy's going to kill me. It's like, doesn't matter whether it's comfort or X or black. These guys just, they just got to clock numbers, right? And I think I can understand that. But
that's the thing actually about utilization and whether it's delivery, DoorDash or Uber is, you know that part of the motivation, right, is you want to do as many jobs as you can in the hour.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily impact you when you're thinking about a line worker in a Henry Ford factory 100 years ago performing more tasks an hour. But when you're sitting in the back of a car or you're on the road when a DoorDash driver is trying to, you know, haul through the bike lane or something like that, that's when you're like, wow, I actually have a little bit of an opinion about the way we're thinking about utilization here.
One of the things which I have, my behavior has changed because of Waymo, because it takes a little longer to arrive.
Yeah.
Somewhere between. So if you're in Soma, it takes less than 10 minutes.
Sure.
If you're in Mission, it takes less than 10 minutes. Anywhere else.
It's like 12, 15. 12
to 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, I use Uber as a backfill. Every time it's above 10 minutes, I'll use Uber.
Yeah.
And now when I use Uber, I used to be like 15% tip guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 25% tip guy because I feel very guilty as to like what the future means for all the people who are helping me get where I am.
Right. Yeah.
And like, probably I've become more nice to people in the service industry because of Waymo. It's like a weird thing.
That's interesting.
Like,
okay.
Like, I feel I have to thank them like, and have a, like, just have a proper thank you.
Yeah.
Because you can tell that this thing is not going to be an easy situation for a big swath of our society, mostly because, you know, people don't think of the gig economy people as the ones who are actually, like, they're like the, that's like the one job creation which has happened.
Sure.
Right? Like, you know, whether we like it or we don't. Mm-hmm. And it's like, without any protection, there is no healthcare, there is no like
sure.
no societal protection for these people.
Yeah.
And I feel that they're going to get caught short by the change, this move to automation.
Yeah, although I think given what's happened this year, I don't think it's going to happen as fast as the futurists had told us, right? You know, 12 months from now, will we have deployment of these systems in 25 major cities in the US? No, I don't think that's the case. I know Cruise had a rollout plan for a lot of maybe as much as 9 or 11 cities, I don't recall, throughout the next year, and that those have been put on pause. Waymo has wisely not rushed into their deployment announcements. So I don't know where they're going to go next other than Los Angeles is kind of the next big city, but I don't know what the next one is after that. I do think it's going to be longer than people think. And because of the way that the world seems to have a dark cloud over talking about vehicle automation, I think that Waymo's own timelines might be pushed back because of it.
The way I think about it, and you've known me long enough, I don't look at the world which is either here and now. My idea of thing is like, what happens in the next 10 years?
Yeah.
I think the next 10 years, this thing is going to be in more places than we think. Maybe not in every city, but like this could be part of major metro experience.
I think that's right. And maybe to your terminology, Uber as a backfill is really where you fill in those suburbs and things where you might not have a dedicated Waymo or such and such service, right?
I don't know the answer, right? Like I thought maybe you have a better idea of like what 10 years look like, next 10 years look like. How do you think about it? I mean, I'm just like reading and talking to a few people. I'm just like making my opinion.
Yeah.
But you live in it.
I mean, I actually think that Waymo would be a level 4 system, meaning it can't operate in every area and every condition. There are conditions where a Waymo can't operate because of a map or because of weather or things like that. And those type of experiences we will have, particularly in high density areas. You need high density because you want to have X number of trips per hour and you want to have a central facility for cleaning them and all those sorts of things. So by definition, they kind of look like how we used to think about a yellow car yellow cab service, but in a lot of different areas. It's possible that Waymo does that. The big question is how do they finance that in this environment or an environment over the next couple of years? And I think one of the maybe radical things that Waymo should take from the Tesla experience is letting individuals actually own the cars. The Tesla framework is that, okay, I own a Model S, but Elon has told me that over time, I'll be able to offer it up to the network so it can drive for me and make money for me. And I think that whether we're talking about Waymo or these other services, they'll eventually get to sort of like decentralized ownership and a fleet funding that comes from individuals in addition to large traditional sources.
Believe me, last 1 month has been Waymo and all Waymo all the time.
Yeah.
I cannot stop thinking about it because I just love this. And I look at the car and I look like, so I've gone deep into like, there are so many breakthroughs happening on the LiDAR front, on the camera front, the chip technologies. Everything is getting smaller. I mean, I see a company like Waymo actually has to go out and say, this is the product spec. This is our car for mobility. Not it doesn't have to be a Jag the way they're using it. It actually has to be a smaller, more nimble kind of a car, which is designed specifically for Waymo things, right?
Yeah.
And unless they do that, they cannot bring the cost down. I don't think, you know, they've had to think about it right now because they just have been pretty much liberally funded by Google. I don't know. This costs like $20 billion to build it out.
Mm-hmm.
But they will actually have to do the same super nuts strategy. And those cars would be fleets, which can be owned by somebody and managed by Waymo. So for instance, like they could offer a franchise for Kansas City to somebody and just say, hey, here is 100 Waymos you can buy from us, run it, our software, everything. We are going to get you insurance from Swiss Realty, everything. You're running like the local McDonald's franchise.
Right. Yeah.
Probably that's the way they expand.
That's exactly how I see the potential for them is that in order to finance the fleets in this environment, there might have to be something like that. Waymo has nowhere near the sort of brand affinity or passion behind it that Tesla does, but let's pretend over time they could figure that out. They are starting to do more manufacturers. The next car is a Chinese-made small minivan by Zeekr, and that will be coming soon. It's really interesting to think about Waymo over time introducing their own spec so that a manufacturer could essentially build clients for them. That's something they haven't done yet, but it's a great idea.
I mean, this is what somebody like Fiat or Volkswagen should be jumping all over it, but they're not.
That's true. The big question with Waymo is, are they only doing this in service of their own fleet where they want to be the manager of all those vehicles? And a Waymo is always something that has a Waymo logo on the side and is a Waymo service.
Like Intel inside, so Waymo inside.
Or that. Or are they going to allow for Waymo to live on other people's
I think it has services? To be a franchise model. Sort of like you look at some of the fastest growing companies in the world, from like Panera Bread to McDonald's to Dunkin'. Like they've been able to grow their brand value and their business value by being franchised and having franchisees. It's like the way I think of it, like all NBA and NFL cities can support Waymo if the cars are cheaper and it's managed by a franchisee.
They have to figure out airports. So the one missing link with Waymo, which I'm sure you've experienced if you've taken a flight in the last month, is they don't go to the airport in San Francisco. They do in Phoenix. And if you look at Uber revenues, about a third of the Uber revenue stream is just business travel to and from an airport. So in order for this to make sense in those kind of big sports towns, like you mentioned, you have to figure out the airport connector, which is not just a technical challenge of going on a freeway. It's also the regulatory and that's sort of the airport mafia piece, right?
That's why you kind of go with the franchisee model, right? Like local people owning
the
local,
like the same person who owns the local yellow cab in St. Louis,
the person who
gets to buy the Waymo, the Waymo franchise in St. Louis.
You know, just sadly, that's the reality of the world right now.
Yeah,
you know, the people who are rich are get the premium picks on the best franchises in the food fast food. It's like pretty much the same model. Like that's the only model that works. And this is probably where I see the failure of imagination on the big three auto companies in the US. It's like they just can't move fast enough to actually think about this as an opportunity. Like a Ford made vehicle plus Waymo plus Swiss Realty as a package to go into a city. And talking to the, like, those are three big entities talking to the government. You know, they can move the machine forward much faster.
Yeah. I think to the Zeekr point, which is a Chinese brand.
Like, why are we using a Chinese company? Like, haven't we learned anything from freaking DJI and TikTok? Like, seriously, people, how stupid can we get?
Well said, but also just on the cost side, a low cost fleet EV. Is something that at the moment the Chinese are really competitive with. And the fact that you don't have to sell it, but you're just putting it in the fleet means you're not susceptible to the tariffs and things you would have to sell a Chinese vehicle, the normal sort of high tariff. So I think it's a really good point. But for the next little while, I think we're going to see a lot of Chinese cars.
Which is a shame. Like it is like a shame because our big three companies are not using imagination. I'm actually surprised that we don't have, by now we should have a competitor to Tesla, which is making smaller cars.
Well, we have Rivian, right?
And Rivian makes a bigger
car. Yeah.
It's a nice truck.
Yeah.
A bit. I'll still take a Bronco.
Yeah. On the Waymo side, I think it's an interesting call to action for the big three to make some in. And maybe the answer for you is the Cruise Origin, which was made for Cruise. Maybe it needs to be sold to Waymo instead and has a Waymo badge on it.
I think the problem with Waymo is that it's owned by Google, which is a company in chaos on its own. So there's always a challenge.
But on the other hand, no one would have committed for that long unless it was Google, right? Mm-hmm. So you perhaps needed to be raised in that unusual household in order to have this brilliant child.
True. So looking out 2024, what does Riley see? What is the AI? What's the role AI plays in mobility? What do you see? What are your thoughts on micromobility? You know, we didn't even touch on that.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting tooling for specific problems that where AI is really great for 2024. One would maybe be, you know, different types of battery chemistries. We've looked at a couple companies that are, instead of kind of going out, the way you, it's interesting the way you kind of make batteries today is it's almost similar to if you've ever been in one of those places where they make perfumes. Mm-hmm. You have these experts that have vials and beakers and things like that, and you ask them what you want to do, and they kind of go in the back and they give you materials which you test in your lab, and then you kind of formulate some hypothesis about what you want the battery to do. That whole function, to be able to do that through AI, would be radically more efficient and cheaper for battery. And so we could probably uncover new chemistries that are better for batteries through AI that we're not doing now. I'm really excited about that. The other piece is just unusual kind of forms and shapes for aviation and aerospace that will allow for better fuel saving. If you think about the land transport has had the brunt of the focus of decarbonization and regulation for carbon emissions. But if you look at the other major industries, whether it's maritime or aviation, that's coming. And aviation specifically is in this fascinating window where at some point in the next few years, Boeing and Airbus have to seal their design for the plane they're going to ship in the next decade. And the big question mark is, are they going to design a plane around maybe hydrogen? Is it going to be a different wing shape to take advantage of aerodynamics in a new way? And a lot of founders that we've seen that previously would have been starting car companies and automated vehicle companies are going into aviation and aerospace. So I've been really surprised by that. So we've, as a result, done a handful more investments in that space. Mm. So next year, more on aviation, aerospace, hydrogen, a little bit more. I think hydrogen is a space that, not for passenger cars, but for commercial vehicles and trucks. If you remember the Nikola scandal from a few years ago, that was kind of the pets.com of the SPAC era, in that we'll remember it as this sort of, you know, idiotic doofus example of what the market gave us. But if you think about pets.com, it's like, well, pets.com represented that time. And if you only thought that the lesson from that was the internet isn't going to work, that was the wrong lesson to take. From Nikola, I think there was this one really bad actor in one company. But there's a lot of fascinating hydrogen stuff for these large format, whether we're talking about planes or trucks. And that is, it, I think, will be a surprising aspect of the next 1 to 5 years.
And for that to work, you think we need to figure out a lot more on the solar side of things?
Well, one, you have a lot more funding for cheaper means of production for hydrogen, that making that cheaper so that you can make hydrogen greener when you make it. And then there's all sorts of, you know, nanomaterials that go inside of a cartridge. So instead of having to stuff a bunch of hydrogen at very high pressure to get enough energy density, in some cases you can line the inside of a tank with material so that you don't have to go to high pressure, but you can still have a lot of energy inside. Yeah. So there's a lot of really great primary stuff going on in hydrogen that, and we funded a little bit of it today.
Well, this has been great to talk about, you know, what's been happening. I personally think, correct me if I'm wrong, that 2003 was an interesting, exciting year from
2023.
Okay. I guess I need some.
2003 was good too, but yeah, 2023. Okay.
2003 was great. Yeah. What are you talking about? Start of social revolution.
All right.
Social web.
I think that's when I started reading you, by the way. Oh, Malik on Broadband. What year was that?
Yeah. That was like 2001, bro.
Oh, yeah. OG.
Yeah. Me. Like.
When you had the fedora in the logo.
I still have a fedora. I just don't wear it. And I don't smoke a cigar no more.
Yeah. Yeah. The logo had the fedora and the cigar. Yeah. Yeah.
And I personally believe that this is the year my idea of present future became very visible. I think mobility became much more clearer. the trends which have been kind of hyperbole for a long time actually took some concrete shape. Whether it is autonomous, you know, whether it is solar, whether it is batteries, whether it's hydrogen, whether it's like using machine learning to develop new products and new materials. All these things were like big ideas which were in the ether, and like it's like a shimmer in an ink which starts to settle down. And that's exactly what I feel like.
I think it's a little bit like a prism where, you know, the futurists kind of tell us X is going to happen. And then when the light goes through the prism, it always comes out at a different angle, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the AV thing, if you look, you know, back at the TED Talks from 2016, like, oh, we're going to sell the gas stations and we're going to, you know, no one's going to own a car and such is out of business. And in reality, a lot of it is now trickled down to very inexpensive ADAS and a few remaining AV players that are doing a great job. Waymo, I would say May Mobility, Gatik. And we'll see how the next few years develop. It's not exactly like what they told us, right?
So you've been around for a while. So 2004 is when I wrote a piece called The Next Wave, which was about mobile. It was on Business 2.0 cover story. And I also wrote another story that year about the micro app economy, which was the whole idea was that new platforms, new ways of more standardized like tools and everything will lead to like a new renaissance software. And, you know, but it took a long time. It took about 10 years for that reality to kind of reach its peak, right? But my whole point is 10 years go by pretty fast. It's 2023.
Right.
I mean, shit, it's been like almost 20 years since I got to know you.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And I think the good point about that is, it doesn't seem strange now that Tesla has such market cap and such market share, but it's happened relatively quickly.
I remember riding in the first Lotus-based Tesla, and, you know, Gigom used to be the first place which would, like, feverishly write about Tesla. Yeah. No one gave a shit about that company.
Yeah.
Because
Katie would write about
like
it.
All over it. Because, and we just, like, and I don't know how to drive, dude. So, like,
Associated Drive.
Yeah. Just so amazing.
Yeah.
And like the way I see it now, it's just like people are talking about like AGI right now. And it's like, man, this like autonomous driving, it takes a lot longer than people think. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to get to what we have today sometime in the near future.
Yeah.
The way they're talking about AGI, which is going to rule us all, is still a ways away. Regardless of all that, like I look at the world right now, if you're a journalist, it's very exciting. If you're a believer in technology, it's very exciting. If you're a naysayer, you're shitting bricks. I'm sorry, but like I don't know how else to describe
it. I think that's a good way of putting it, or the old, you know, Silicon Valley saying, like, the pessimists get to be right and the optimists get to be wealthy. I'm a believer that particularly right now, the founders who are building companies in all these different spaces, choosing to go out in this market and raise rounds and build companies are of a kind of a different type of person that wants to do that. So it's pretty exciting to put some numbers behind it. We see about 1,000 companies a year, trucks. So around 90 companies a month. And last month we saw something like 139 companies, brand new companies. These are not like Series C. These are all just green shoots, brand new companies to give you an idea of how many people are building in this space now. And part of it is founders, particularly in the, whether it's climate tech related transportation, they feel a mission to build in this space that's very different than if you go back 5 or 6 years ago. There were a lot of people building automated vehicle companies in 2016 after the Cruise acquisition announcement who were mercenaries. They were not missionaries. They might have arrived at our office and said, I've always cared about vehicle safety and I've always wanted to do this. In reality, they just wanted to build a startup. I think the new breed of founders that's building in climate-related technology is probably going to be building that space for the rest of their life. And so they're very mission-oriented about it. And we've seen just a ton of them.
Riley, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Good to catch up.
Thanks, Om Dad.
You should do this once a year.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah. Man. Appreciate
it's a good time, right? Like once a year.
Great time.
I don't need to talk to you more than that. No, for work.
Like, right.
Just
right,
as a
right,
friend.
Right.
I, you know, like, and I can only make you coffee once a year.
That's right. This is it. Thanks,
otherwise,
Om.
We have to keep the coffee shops open.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it, and this was great.
Thanks, Om. Appreciate it.